Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's program. At this time, all lines are in a listen-only mode. However, later in the program, you will have the opportunity to register to ask questions. Tonight's conference is being recorded. And at this time, it is my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Shiraz Dubinsky with Sharit. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mike. Good evening, everyone. My name is Shiraz Dubinsky, and I am the clinical supervisor at Sharit. We'd like to welcome you to tonight's national teleconference entitled Breast Cancer Survivors, What You Need to Know About Recent Developments in Genetics. This has been a banner year in the world of breast cancer genetics. Angelina Jolie announced to the world that she tested BRCA positive and opted to undergo a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy. The Supreme Court ruled against Myriad's patent on the BRCA gene, enabling other labs to test high-risk individuals and their families for hereditary cancers. And finally, there are new testing panels that are changing the way we are identifying genetic mutations that may predispose to a cancer diagnosis. As a result of this trifecta, Sharit has been busy fielding questions that are triggered by these events. We have been fielding calls from women and their families who are interested in learning more about genetic counseling and testing, and from women who tested BRCA negative and are wondering if they should undergo further testing. So we hear you loud and clear, and that is why we chose to address the recent developments in genetics this evening. As an organization with an expertise in Jewish families, we feel compelled to raise awareness about hereditary cancer because 1 in 40 individuals of Ashkenazi Jewish descent carry the BRCA mutation. Our goal tonight is to answer the many medical, legal, financial, and emotional questions and concerns that have been posed to us over the past year. Tonight's teleconference is part of our survivorship series. We are committed to presenting topics that are on the forefront of the minds of breast cancer survivors. So in addition to these teleconferences, our survivorship program, which is called Thriving Again, offers conversations with Sharit's genetic counselor, peer support, and a free personalized survivorship kit. So if you haven't already received your personalized Thriving Again survivorship kit, send us an email right now to info@sharsherit.org with your name and contact number, and we'll be in touch with you tomorrow. I would like to thank our panel of experts for joining us this evening, and following their presentation, there will be an opportunity for questions and answers. So without further ado, I would like to introduce our first speaker. Danielle Singer is a graduate of Brandeis University with an MS in genetic counseling. She has many professional affiliations, including the National Society of Genetic Counselors, and serves as the secretary for the Human Genetics Association of New Jersey. Prior to joining Sharit, she worked as a genetic counselor at the Yale Cancer Center, where she counseled individuals and families about hereditary cancer risk. As part of Sharit's genetics program, Danielle provides supportive counseling, information, and resources regarding hereditary breast cancer and ovarian cancer to women diagnosed or at high risk of developing breast cancer and ovarian cancer and their families, including men. Tonight, Danielle will be speaking about developments in genetics research. Danielle, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Sharit. I am delighted to be on this webinar tonight to speak to you about the new developments in the field of cancer genetics and to introduce you to Sharit's Genetics for Life program and everything it has to offer. You may be wondering why you should revisit the topic of genetics as a breast cancer survivor, especially if you have already had genetic testing. As new developments are made, you may want to consider additional testing. This testing may clarify risks for other cancers, such as ovarian cancer, and importantly, has relevance for risk to family members. As the field of genetics changes, women who have had genetic testing years ago are calling Sharit to learn more and to inquire whether further counseling and testing is necessary. Some are calling for help managing the overwhelming decisions that come along with a positive genetic test result, But perhaps most importantly, women and families are calling Sharsheret to discuss what genetics means for their own lives, health, and for their families. So before I delve into what is new in the world of cancer genetics, I would like to just provide a context for some of those listening tonight. Although many of you may have already heard this information before, been through the genetic counseling process, or even had genetic testing. As a reminder, we know that 90% of cancer diagnoses are actually sporadic, and only about 5 to 10% of them are hereditary. Two genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2, although some refer to them as BRCA1 and BRCA2, are responsible for the majority of hereditary breast cancer. BRCA1 and BRCA2 are genes that we all carry, and every single one of us has two copies, one from mom and one from dad. The job of these genes is to protect our bodies against breast and ovarian cancer. So these genes are important for our bodies to function. Two copies should be there, and two copies should be working. However, sometimes in families, we find individuals who carry what is called a mutation in one of these genes. A mutation is similar to a spelling error. So if we think of a gene as a long sentence that our body reads through, sometimes individuals can carry a single typo in a single letter, which impairs the body's ability to read through the gene properly, thereby producing an increased risk for breast and ovarian cancer, since there is less protection against these cancers. BRCA1 and BRCA2 are long genes. There are many places within the gene where mutations can exist. However, we know that 1 in 40 Ashkenazi Jews, or Jews of Eastern European descent, carries one of three very specific mutations found in specific places in these genes. Often, when an individual of Ashkenazi Jewish descent pursues BRCA genetic testing, the testing will begin with just those three mutations. If that person is negative, often testing will proceed to what we call sequencing, which is essentially a read-through of the entire BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, letter by letter, looking for spelling errors or mutations. So recently, there have been many changes and updates in the field of cancer genetics and the technologies which are used in genetic testing. The first update I'd like to discuss is called BART, which stands for BRCA Rearrangement Test. BART is essentially another way of looking at BRCA. Instead of scanning the gene letter by letter to look for mutations or typos, BART is a different technology which looks for chunks of the gene which may have been deleted or rearranged. This test became available in 2006. So if you had genetic testing prior to 2006 and tested negative, it may be worth recontacting your genetic counselor or genetics professional to discuss whether you might consider rearrangement testing. Another technology which is now widely being integrated into clinical practice are cancer gene panels. Technology now allows for testing of multiple genes at the same time, between 10 and 50 or even more. As scientists learn more about hereditary cancer, other genes besides BRCA1 and BRCA2 have been identified, which can be associated with an increased risk for breast cancer. These panels can now test for mutations in any gene that has ever been proven to even have a slight association with an increased risk for breast cancer, or other panels exist for other types of cancers. Sometimes, the more testing that is done, the more chances there are for ambiguity. It is possible for someone to undergo a panel test and then unexpectedly discover they carry a gene mutation associated with a hereditary colon cancer syndrome, despite their breast cancer history. It is also possible to be told, "We found a mutation in a gene we think is associated with an increased risk for breast cancer, but we don't know a lot about this gene." It can be distressing and confusing for people to hear information from this type of test that they were not expecting to hear. It can also make it very difficult to guide medical management for genes that we know little about. Other considerations to think about are cost, insurance coverage, risk for other cancers, and how this information will affect your medical management, your emotional well-being, and risk to other family members. These panels, however, can prove extremely useful in cases where personal and family history are unclear or when previous genetic testing does not provide an answer. Genetic counselors and providers are sometimes baffled when an individual has a strong family history of breast and/or ovarian cancer, and genetic testing for BRCA is negative. Doing panel testing has the potential to clarify risks and discover a cause of cancer in the family. Panel testing can also be useful when limited family history is known to suggest one hereditary cancer syndrome over a different one associated with breast cancer. For example, it can be challenging to track family history for individuals who have lost family members in the Holocaust, or for individuals who have been adopted. As scientists learn more about these genes, there is great potential for these panels to be expanded or revised to discover new causes of hereditary cancer or to clarify personal and family hereditary cancer risk. Recently, I attended the National Society of Genetic Counselors conference in California. There was a lot of buzz about these cancer panels at this conference. So as breast cancer survivors, if you have already seen a genetic counselor or had genetic testing, is it worth pursuing a panel? Depending on your specific set of circumstances and family history, it might be. I strongly recommend checking with your genetic counselor or me at Sharseret to discuss if this or any other additional testing would be applicable for you. So how does Sharseret address these recent developments and important concerns and questions that Jewish women and their families have? Sharseret's Genetics for Life program provides resources, information, and individualized genetic conversations to Jewish women and families facing a cancer diagnosis or at risk due to their strong family history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer. Additionally, we educate and inform healthcare professionals about the specific concerns of Jewish women and Jewish families, including their increased risk for hereditary breast cancer and ovarian cancer. Through our genetic counselor hotline, you can call to speak with a genetic counselor, namely me. This hotline is an opportunity for individuals to connect to Sharseret to receive free, tailored, and confidential individual support and to have questions answered about genetics, family history, and genetic counseling. Our peer support network connects women one-on-one with others who are at increased risk or been through a similar experience. Family conference calls are a unique feature of the program. This feature allows women to conference with family, partners, or friends to discuss any genetics-related concern with the assistance of a genetic counselor. I have spoken with families about communicating genetic information, strategies for testing, medical decision-making, and much more. We also nationally distribute our culturally relevant book, Your Jewish Genes, which addresses frequently asked questions about breast cancer and ovarian cancer genetics and shares personal stories of women relating to genetics. Our Have the Talk campaign is a national cancer genetics campaign, which encourages college students and young men and women to begin critical family conversations about their medical history. Participants pledge to have the talk and can use an online pedigree to record their family cancer history and access Sharseret's culturally relevant resources and the Genetics for Life program to discuss their personal issues and concerns. Lastly, our health seminars, teleconferences, and webinars like this one are presented nationwide to educate Jewish women and men about the importance of understanding family medical history and to address genetics-related concerns. After this teleconference, I highly encourage you to call Sharseret and discuss any questions or concerns you have with me and get connected with our Genetics for Life program if you have not done so already. I look forward to connecting with each and every one of you.
Thank you, Danielle. As you were speaking, I was thinking that several years ago, Sharseret hosted a teleconference on genetics, and we focused on the BRCA genes. So it's exciting to see how much the field of genetics has now expanded, and we at Sharseret continue to be committed to keeping up with all these new testing options. Our next expert is Dr. Karen Hurley. Dr. Hurley is a licensed clinical psychologist specializing in hereditary cancer risk. After completing a postdoctoral research fellowship in behavioral oncology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, she spent 8 years on faculty at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, providing services for high-risk patients and conducting research on patient decision-making about prophylactic surgery and other psychosocial issues relevant to familial cancer. She is now in private practice in New York City with adjunct faculty appointments at Memorial Sloan Kettering and Teachers College, Columbia University. She frequently presents lectures, teleconferences, and workshops to United States and international audiences, including patients and patient groups, professional societies, and healthcare facilities. Dr. Hurley is a member of several national advisory boards, and tonight she will be discussing decision-making and communicating with your family. Dr. Hurley?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've admired the work of Sharsherit for many years, and I was delighted to get the invitation to talk with you tonight. So just touching briefly on some of the things that makes being a BRCA carrier emotionally challenging, of all the different issues that people come to me with, probably the most wrenching can be dealing with the risk to children and how to talk with children. And that can be whether it's your adult child or a young child or teenager. It doesn't matter. There's something about the risk passing from one generation to the next that becomes highly poignant. So people will often ask me, how do I tell my child about my risk? And there are really two levels to that question. On one level, people will be looking for the right words. You know, is there some way to say this that's going to make it okay for my child? But another level to the question is, how do I go through with this? How do I deal with the emotional challenge of sitting down and having this conversation? So I'd like to speak to both levels. I think one of the hardest things about BRCA mutations is their random nature. As Danielle pointed out, if you're a carrier, you have a 50-50 risk of passing mutation on to someone else. And as far as we know, at least from the science, there's nothing that predicts who's going to inherit a mutation and who doesn't. It's a 50-50 flip each time. So that's from the science point of view. From the spiritual point of view, people may have beliefs about the nature of suffering or why a certain person faces challenges or has a certain life path. But regardless of your belief about how this happens, it comes to a point where you run up against the limit of human understanding for this situation, and you can't see into the future about how this is going to turn out. Am I going to get cancer or not? Is my child going to get cancer or not? If I have this surgery, will that take care of the risk or not? So these are all challenging things to think about. So another way that I express this is, you know, talking about, if we think about cancer as the C word, the thing that's hard to talk about, I actually think the real C word in all of this is control. Because what happens is when you can't control passing on this mutation, you start to recognize the limits of not just controlling the effects of cancer in your life, but really controlling what happens to people you love in general. Now, control has kind of a negative connotation. You know, we have the expression control freak. But really, this urge to control and protect comes from the deepest part of our nature. It comes from that mammalian part of us, the mother lion, who will do anything and everything to protect her cubs. So when people are in the grips of that feeling, they're reaching for something that will satisfy it. And it may not necessarily make logical sense. It may not match what the genetic counselor is telling you or your physician is telling you. For example, people can feel guilty about having passed on the mutation. Now, you may logically know that you yourself did not choose to pass this on. In fact, if you could have stopped it, you would have. However, if you, that helpless feeling of not being able to protect is so difficult to stomach, that some people would rather take the responsibility and say, I did this, rather than the scarier position of, I can't protect the people I love completely. Okay? So another thing that happens is that people feel guilty that somehow they've ruined someone else's life. They're harming them in some way. And have ideas that, you know, what makes me a good parent is keeping bad things from happening to my child, or keeping the child from having bad feelings. Now, this can extend to relatives, too. So, you know, trying to control other people's experiences of this can become very challenging. Another way that people try to exert control is through silence, by not telling, by withholding information, you know, maybe waiting until the right time or until the child is older, or waiting for an adult daughter till after she gets out of college so that she has, you know, a good idyllic time away, things like that. So the thing is that it may be well meant, but it can backfire and isolate people from each other, because even when, even if you're not, you know, you're trying your best to cover what's happening, people can sense it anyway. You know, people overhear, you know, a child might overhear half of a conversation that you're having, or just sense that someone's going to medical appointments more often, or, you know, stop talking when someone comes in the room. So from that standpoint, I've seen sometimes in families that people will decide to delay disclosure, and then the person that they were trying to protect actually gets mad and feels like their trust has been violated. What else are you keeping from me? So so it is important to have this conversation to maintain connection, because this is a lifetime condition, right? The risk doesn't change. You can do things about the risk and you can monitor it, but the genes stay the same. So therefore, what you really want to focus on, rather than focusing on trying to control your relative's experience about whether they have good feelings or bad feelings, is rather to focus on building up trust and giving people the opportunity to step up, to help, to surprise you with the level of support that they can offer. Okay. Another piece of advice I often suggest is to, especially as emotions start getting heated, is to think about the advice you get on the airplane. Put your mask on first before you try to help someone else, you know, when they say the oxygen level is low. So what that means is that if you're feeling upset and you're trying to think about, okay, what's going to, you know, how am I going to manage my child's experience? What you may be not facing is the extent to which you have that painful feeling of feeling guilty, feeling anxious, feeling helpless, feeling out of control. So it's really important to acknowledge those feelings in yourself and tend to them, to get to talk with somebody, identify someone who can be a good support to you, and then you can turn around and then make a decision about how to have a conversation with your child or with your relative that serves the family connection. Okay, and each person can contribute to that by tending to their own presence. To what extent are people listening to each other, being present to each other? To what extent are you exercising good coping skills to deal with your own feelings? And then that helps you be more present to each other, and it opens up space for conversation. Okay? So I think the other thing I wanted to point out, and again, this just speaks to what makes this such a challenge, is that when we're talking about hereditary risk and we're talking about cancer, we're talking about, when we talk about genetics, we're talking about learning about risk in order to take steps to mitigate that risk, to make it, to gain some measure of risk reduction. But it does, ironically, put mortality on the table because we have culturally, even now, even with all the progress that we've made about cancer, we have this association in our heads about mortality. So what happens then is, it's such a scary thought that one of the ways that we sort of soothe that thought is to then think of the next generation, who's going to carry on. But the hereditary risk goes straight to the heart of that defense, that protection, because the thing that's helping you feel better about this feeling that you're facing is also threatened. Okay? So what I want to say in closing is basically what I have learned over the years from sitting with many, many people who have gone through genetic testing, talked through their family conflicts, made their decisions about whether or not to have preventive surgeries, is that facing cancer and facing cancer risk basically forces you to think about things that most people don't want to think about, the things that we put our blinders on to protect ourselves from, and that is that we're all subject to random events, not just mutations. We're all, without exception, subject to hard times, and we're all subject to mortality. Okay? So what talking about risk does and what talking about cancer does is just brings this to the fore. So really what I've seen is that people are their most individual when they are facing cancer and cancer risk. So as a way to balance this then, if you think about it, this is just, I call it the other facts of life. And what we have in this challenge is also the opportunity to think about what do we want our legacy to be. It's so easy to focus on that single mutation as a legacy that really when we have so much more to offer, there's so much that we are passing from one generation to the next. And it's not just our genetic material, but it's also how we face challenge. Our children and our relatives are learning from us, what do we have to teach about facing uncertainty and facing hard times? That is the true gift that we have to give to each other. So I will stop there, and thank you very much for your attention.
Dr. Hurley, thank you so much for your insights. I think that this highlights why it's so important to make sure that you're having conversations with a genetic counselor to go over some of these issues. Sometimes, people often think about genetic testing and they are focused on the actual testing itself, and they forget that there's a whole genetic counseling piece that they can benefit from. And how to communicate with your family members is certainly one of the things that a genetic counselor can discuss with you. So on the heels of what Danielle had shared, I do want to encourage all of you to take what Dr. Hurley has shared with us this evening and give Danielle a call in the Sharsheret office if you would like to speak about your particular family situation. Our final speaker this evening is Anya Prince. Anya is a staff attorney for the Cancer Legal Resource Center, and as a Cancer Legal Resource Center staff attorney, Ms. Prince leads outreach efforts to provide education about the legal rights surrounding genetic testing, provides legal services and resources to those experiencing cancer-related legal issues, and comments on regulations and proposed legislation to improve genetic testing laws. Ms. Prince was the recipient recipient of a Skadden Fellowship and provided underserved communities with education about legal rights surrounding genetic testing while offering legal services to those experiencing genetic discrimination.
Pardon the interruption, everyone. We seem to be experiencing some technical difficulty. Please stand by. We'll be back underway here in just a moment. And once again, thank you for bearing with us. We'll be back underway here shortly. We'll be reconnecting our presenter here in just a moment.
Hello.
Hello. I believe she was going to turn the floor over to another speaker. So if that speaker is ready, you'd be more than welcome to go ahead and proceed.
Hi, this is Anya Prince. Let me know if you can hear me okay.
Yes, okay. We can hear you just fine. Thank you.
Great. Sorry, my audio was cutting out right when the introduction was happening, so I apologize for the delay. But as she mentioned, my name is Anya, and I'm a staff attorney at the Cancer Legal Resource Center. And just to give you a general overview of our organization, we provide free legal information and resources to cancer patients, survivors, and healthcare professionals in the field. And I was there, or I am there on a fellowship. I had a fellowship, and now I'm a staff attorney there, to expand our resources to people with genetic predispositions to cancer. And so I've done a lot of work with some of the legal concerns that crop up with genetic predisposition to cancer. I do just want to take a short moment to talk about the differences of somebody who's already been diagnosed with cancer versus somebody who has a predisposition or has not been diagnosed and has a family history of cancer. There are different laws that are going to apply in those different arenas. So once somebody has already had a diagnosis, there's laws such as healthcare reform and the Americans with Disabilities Act that do protect people who have a history of cancer or have a diagnosis of cancer. What I'll talk about today mostly are those laws that protect the family members who have not had cancer or that protect the genetic information in and of itself. And so it's just important to keep that in mind that as a survivor, you may have slightly different concerns for family member who is going through this who hasn't yet been diagnosed, and that's really some of the laws that I'm going to be talking about. So as Dr. Hurley mentioned, there can be concerns about how this might affect a family member, and so there are laws that protect somebody who has a family history or a genetic test result in this area. So one of the main laws in this area is the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. The Genetic Information and Non-Discrimination Act is often called GINA, and GINA prohibits genetic discrimination in both health insurance and employment. So it is really narrow in the sense that it only covers health insurance and employment, and it does not cover all employers or all health insurance companies. So it's really important to make sure that you would fall under that law. So in the area of employment, it covers state and local governments or private employers with 15 or more employees. And it stops those employers from using genetic information to discriminate. So they can't fire somebody or refuse to hire or pay somebody less because of a family history or a genetic test result. In the employment side, it does not cover federal employees or private people who work for small businesses with fewer than 15 employees. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that you're not covered at all if you work for the federal government or if you work for a small business. There are other protections at the state level or in the federal government, but it's important to just make sure that you know where the protections lie. In the health insurance arena, GINA gives similar protections. So it prohibits a health insurance company from denying somebody insurance or charging somebody a higher premium based on genetic information. Now, again, this is a really important area where having already had the cancer diagnosis is going to be different than just the genetic information or just the genetic test result. And so health insurance companies, until January of this upcoming year, January 2014, can look at the medical information, the medical diagnosis in some situations, but not the genetic information. After January 2014, with healthcare reform implementation, health insurance companies will not be able to take into consideration either the genetic information or any other medical information. So there's going to be broader protection beginning in January. Health insurance companies and employers are also prohibited from collecting genetic information at all unless they fall under a specific subcategory or specific exception. But for the most part, they aren't allowed to purchase any genetic information from somebody or to request or require that somebody give that information. And this is an area where it's really important to keep in mind the definition of genetic information within this law. GINA defines genetic information to include not just a genetic test result, so not just a BRCA test, but also family medical history, the use of genetic services, such as speaking to a genetic counselor, or participation in genetic research. So that's really comforting to know that just going to talk to a genetic counselor or calling up Shasharit to talk about some of these concerns is protected genetic information in and of itself that an employer can't ask you about or a health insurance company can't necessarily gain access to. The family members is also very broadly defined in GINA. So the genetic information includes the medical history of family members, and that includes up to four generations removed, your fourth degree relatives. And so that's, you know, your great-great-great-grandparent, but also your grandparents' relatives going back down the line, so your second cousin twice removed, or, you know, there's all those sorts of family relationships. But it really is quite broad, so it helps to protect somebody from learning or guessing that you have genetic a genetic predisposition to cancer, just from learning about further relatives out. Now, even with these protections, unfortunately, there have been some specific cases of genetic discrimination that we've either seen at the CLRC or has been in the news. The EEOC is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and they are in charge of enforcing the employment protections of GINA. And so they have been taking some cases and litigating them when employers have violated GINA. Often that's coming up in the context of asking about family medical history in a wellness program or in a medical questionnaire that an employer gives. So most of the cases that have come up in this arena are about that. There haven't been too many cases filed yet that say, or that have been litigated all the way through so that we get a result, that say that somebody, an employer, had discriminated against them. There's been a couple of stories in the news where, for example, a woman in Connecticut said that she had been fired once her employer found out about the genetic information, but that case settled, and so we don't have any case law that helps us to understand how courts are going to deal with this in the future. In the health insurance arena, the enforcement provisions are slightly different. If you feel like you've been discriminated against in the area of health insurance, you go through the state's Department of Insurance, which means that in every single state, the process is going to look a little bit different. What I have found in my advocacy is the number one thing is to appeal directly to the insurance company. So some of the situations that I've seen have been the charges of increased premiums because of somebody's genetic information. In some cases, unfortunately, I've seen insurance denials based on the prophylactic mastectomy that somebody got. Now, again, many of these issues will be moot when it comes to January, where an insurance company can't use any medical information. And so the insurance companies will be much less likely to violate both that portion and the portion of GINA. I think some of the violations that I've seen have been insurance companies just not properly training all of their staff yet about GINA. So I think that there is going to be a lot of progress in the concerns that people have once healthcare reform is fully implemented. And it will also protect many of you who are survivors from having a denial based on a pre-existing condition of your cancer diagnosis. So it will allow for much more movement with insurance. One of the major gaps in GINA is that it does not cover life insurance, long-term care insurance, or disability insurance. And so these are areas where I get a lot of calls about because people are concerned naturally about wanting to make sure that their family is covered. So if you know that you have a family history, you know you have a genetic predisposition or tested positive for BRCA, it's natural to want to go and get disability insurance or life insurance. And unfortunately, there are still gaps in this area where many companies across the country can take into account genetic information. What you have to do in this area is look to the state law. And so some states, and increasingly more of them, have begun to pass laws in this area that protect against the use of genetic information in these within these companies. But unfortunately, very few states ban the use of genetic information outright. What they do is regulate how those companies can use genetic information. So California has the strongest protections at this point. They ban those life, long-term care, and disability insurance companies from denying somebody or discriminating against somebody based on a genetic predisposition. Unfortunately, there may be ways where the insurance company can still do what's called a price differential, where they charge a higher premium for somebody because they're, quote-unquote, more risky because of the family history. And so even in a state with the strongest protections, there still may be a chance where somebody could charge a different amount. And many other states that do have protections also allow for that, what's called, quote-unquote, fair discrimination. As an advocate in this area, I don't see it as fair, but unfortunately that's the way that the law is written in many states where it allows, quote-unquote, fair discrimination, meaning that if there's higher medical risk, then the insurance company is allowed to charge higher premiums. And so there still are many gaps within the life, long-term care, and disability insurance arena. It's a difficult area because many people then think, well, should you know, that could be a concern of whether or not to get tested. I think one thing that I often comment on is in many of these states, even if there's some protection, it mostly defines genetic information as a genetic test result, which means that company would still have access to family history. And so taking that genetic test isn't necessarily going to give the insurance company that much more information than they already had, but it sure will give your family a lot of extra medical information and the ability to take those preventive measures that you feel comfortable with. And so when it comes to balancing whether or not to get tested because of those insurance concerns, I do think there are concerns to be aware of, but I don't think it should necessarily preclude testing. I think that's a choice between doctors and genetic counselors and family members. I also want to briefly talk about some of the other issue areas that have come up in this arena. So as was mentioned in the beginning of the program, one of the big events this year was the Supreme Court decision in the Myriad case. So Myriad Genetics had a patent on the BRCA gene, which means that they could stop any other entity within the United States from doing the genetic test in clinical practice or for monetary gain, and in some situations stop research on this gene as well. And the ACLU and a couple of other actors filed a suit against Myriad Genetics claiming that the patents were unconstitutional. And so this case went up to the Supreme Court, and the ACLU and others argued that that DNA are what's called products of nature and therefore not legally patentable. And the Supreme Court, in a huge decision that was a unanimous decision, said that it's true that certain types of DNA are in fact unpatentable, and so you can't have a patent on it. Now, they did leave open a small category where a type of DNA called cDNA is patentable. But to give you sort of an idea of why of how this case was argued, the case talked a lot about this type of analogy. So in patent law, products of nature are not allowed to be patented. So you can't patent a tree because it just grew in nature. And so the ACLU said that patenting a gene was like patenting a tree leaf, because if you snap off the leaf off of the tree, it doesn't make it not a product of nature. So they were arguing that when Myriad Genetics took out the BRCA gene, it's still just a product of nature because they're sort of removing the part from the whole. What Myriad Genetics argued is they said, no, it's not like a tree leaf. It's more like a baseball bat, right? So you can make a baseball bat out of a tree, and because you're manipulating that product of nature so much, it becomes a patentable process. And so the Supreme Court sort of fell right in the middle of it, where it said cDNA, which is a type of DNA where you're creating more, you're taking out more of the parts to create this cDNA, that's patentable because you're manipulating enough to pull it out of a product of nature. But the general DNA, just isolated DNA, is not patentable. And what this means is that Myriad Genetics now cannot be the exclusive group that does the BRCA gene. So there's been a number of different companies who are now offering the BRCA gene. And hopefully that means that there'll be more data out there. And so some of those ambiguous genes that Danielle was talking about, hopefully we'll get enough data so that we start to understand those in the medical community. I also briefly want to mention, and I can take some questions on this later if people do have questions, one of the other areas that I do get a lot of questions about is how to get insurance coverage for those preventive measures that you might want to take once finding out that there's a BRCA gene. So it could be, how do I get insurance coverage for genetic counseling and testing itself, but also how do I get insurance coverage for prophylactic mastectomy or maybe a mammogram for that. And so with healthcare reform, there's a lot of changes that have come about where health insurance companies in general are required to cover genetic counseling specifically for the BRCA gene. And as part of that, they also have to cover the cost of testing itself. Now, this is only for people for whom it's medically required. You know, somebody with no family history whatsoever probably can't just walk up and get this. But they have to cover it absolutely free of cost to the patient. This doesn't apply to all insurance companies, but it does apply to some. Another piece that has to be covered free of cost for many people over the age of 40 are mammograms. The trick with this is they only have to cover preventive mammographies. And so unfortunately, if somebody has already been diagnosed with breast cancer and maybe has been in remission for years, when they go to get a mammography, oftentimes it's coded in the medical side as diagnostic because it tells the radiologist to look for something different. And because of that coding, the insurance company doesn't have to treat it like a preventive mammography, and therefore they don't have to cover it absolutely free of cost. They will still cover it most likely, but it's just the absolutely free of cost part that doesn't fall in. But when working with insurance companies, it's very essential to never take no for an answer. Give our organization a call or go on our website. We have a lot of information about insurance appeals, and I'm sure everybody at Trisheric can also help with that. But it's really important to push back in these arenas, especially in the case of genetic testing and preventive services, because these are so new, oftentimes the insurance companies haven't quite gotten their protocols down, and it's a good area to push back to. So I think in all of this, if you feel like you're being discriminated against, or anybody in your family is, or if there's been a denial or an increased premium in any of those life long-term care, it's always really important to try to push back and to go through the appeals. And so I'll stop there, but I'm happy to take questions at the end, and thank you so much.
Anya, thank you for your takeaway about advocating for yourself. I think that's probably the most important thing, and you're right. We will certainly encourage our callers to call the Cancer Legal Resource Center. And also, you know, here at Shosheret, those are things that we can also help you with as well and make sure you get to the right resource. Before we continue, I just want to apologize for being cut out before. It felt like maybe there was a mutation in our technology, but we are back on. And we are ready to have questions and answers. I am going to invite Mike, the operator, to explain how to go ahead and pose a question. We ask that you keep your questions broad in nature so that everyone joining us this evening will benefit from the discussion. And certainly, if you have any individualized questions, please feel free to contact Shosheret's genetic counselor tomorrow, and she can speak with you personally. So while the questions are coming in, we did receive several questions prior to the teleconference that I'm going to go ahead and present to our speakers. So, Anya, a lot of the things that you were discussing related to people who are at risk. Can you also perhaps briefly talk about how this applies to women who have already been diagnosed, or is there a difference?
Sure. So the important thing to keep in mind is with GINA, genetic information in and of itself is always going to be protected. But the disease that manifests from that genetics is going to be protected by different laws. So once you've already developed cancer or had a diagnosis, other laws are going to apply. So employers are still not allowed to take into account your cancer diagnosis and discriminate in those arenas under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So there's protection similar to GINA for those individuals who have been diagnosed. Similarly, in the life, long-term care, and disability insurance arenas, there are also fewer protections for somebody who has already had a cancer diagnosis in this arena. It's not impossible to get life insurance or disability insurance after cancer diagnosis, but it does depend on how long ago you were diagnosed, what stage of diagnosis you're at, and other factors. With healthcare reform, there's a lot of changes, as I mentioned, for survivors. And I think personally that one of the biggest things is that beginning January 1st of this year, or of this upcoming year, no health insurance company is going to be able to deny somebody based on a pre-existing condition. And they also are not allowed to charge a higher premium for anybody who has any medical condition. And so this will change the field drastically because after you've had a cancer diagnosis, you know, for so many of us, health insurance is tied to your employment. So even if you want to take time off work to go through cancer treatments, it might be hard, but after health care reform goes into effect, that may be more of a possibility for people.
Great. Thank you. Danielle, it seems that there's a lot of information coming quickly about the panels. How do you know which panel to order and from which company? And does some testing tell you information that other tests don't, and how do you know which is best for you?
That's a great question.
Ma'am, I'm sorry, pardon the interruption. I hate to interrupt you. This is Mike, the coordinator. If I could give the audience instructions on how to queue up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Before we
right.
progress.
Go ahead.
Thank you. If you would like to register to ask a question, it is star and one on your touch-tone phone. Once again, it is star and one if you'd like to register to ask a question. And we'll turn the call over now to our hosts again. I'm sorry to interrupt once more.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate that, Mike. Danielle, do you want to go ahead and field that question?
Sure. That's actually a great question that I receive all the time. And the short answer is that genetic counselors are still figuring that out. So there are many, many companies that are offering different types of testing. So even just in the realm of hereditary breast cancer, some companies, you know, go through a certain process to decide what genes to include on their panel. Other companies go through a different process to decide what genes are included on their panel. And so I think really it's a decision that genetic counselors and medical providers are really looking at how to evaluate these technologies for their patients because, you know, we are very protective of our patients and we want to make sure that they are getting the full testing that is appropriate for them and at the cost that is appropriate for them as well. So, you know, there's a lot, basically there are many, many things to think about, such as cost, insurance coverage, which genes are included on the panel, you know, what is the turnaround time, how quickly do the results come back, does the lab have financial assistance available, those types of things. So really the short answer is that we are still evaluating it, and it's an exploding field. So really there are just many, many options.
Thank you, Danielle. Dr. Hurley, you focused a lot about speaking to your own children about the genetic risk, and we're getting some questions actually about other family members who are not necessarily a woman's own children. One woman said, it turns out that she doesn't have any children of her own, but her sister has. We received a question about the men and sons in the family, and I was wondering if you had any particular insights about these other family members.
Mm-hmm. Great. These are both some really important issues. So, number one, the way that the mutations are transmitted means that the line of an individual of a family is somewhat blurred, so that you know, we tend to think of, you know, for each you know, nuclear family unit, you know, that the you know, the parent is kind of the gatekeeper, if you will, of information. So a common conflict is someone who's a breast cancer survivor wants to give the and is a mutation carrier, wants to give the information to say her nieces, but the sister doesn't want to deal with it, doesn't want to get tested, and is trying again to you know, control the information. So you know, a couple of you know, the situations become very complex, but a couple of guidelines is, number one, especially if you feel someone's angry or in denial, instead of you know, sort of going head to head with them about taking that denial away, it's more to start empathizing with, where does that denial come from? Denial is it's a defensive maneuver signaling that underneath that person is either sad, fearful, feeling helpless, and they're grasping at denial as a way to deal with that. So so that can kind of cool the situation down enough so you can get to that place where you're listening to each other again. The other thing is that especially, you know, there's more and more information out there about BRCA, especially now that Angelina Jolie has come out, people, you know, that teens have access to this, young women have access to this. So the information is out there. So sometimes the children are coming to the parents with questions. So, again, I think it's important for people to listen to, you know, what the child is telling you about what they want to know or not know, and also to trust that that the information will get to them one way or another, especially as the awareness is raised more. So that if you're becoming concerned about, say, a 25-year-old niece who doesn't know that she should be tested, you know, the fact that she knows that maybe you're a breast cancer survivor will more easily trigger that question in her mind than it may have done even 5 years ago. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about men and sons. So there's a lot of research going on, and Danielle can speak to more about this, about what the risks are to men who are carriers, and there are some elevated risks of breast cancer, of cancers, depending on whether it's BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation. But in general, the overall risk of cancer is less to the men. So they're in the situation of, it's especially hard for fathers who are may have passed on a mutation to a daughter. So it's something that doesn't affect them so much, but greatly affects the women that they love. So so everything that I said about helplessness goes triple for them, because they would want to take that on for themselves if they could. I've seen some men reacting with incredible feelings of guilt about this. And they have a hard time sort of standing by. You know, in our culture, men are socialized to be doers and like to have something to do. So watching a loved one go through a surgery and there's nothing for them to do, they have nowhere to channel that. So, you know, having different ways to address that with the male relatives, you know, whether that's, you know, just simply acknowledging their feelings, giving them tasks to do, letting them be the take the job of the researcher, or you know, showing them, you know, what they can do to support the family so that they can fill a role and not just be in that place of standing by. Hello? Hello?
Anya, thank you. Dr. Hurley,
okay,
thank
sorry.
You. Anya.
sorry.
We are hearing from several women, actually, that they're a little hesitant to undergo genetic testing because they're worried that it may jeopardize their disability benefits through their employers. Have you ever had this experience? And if so, how would you recommend handling it?
Sure. So it's definitely a concern that does come up. And as I mentioned, the disability insurance companies may have access to just family history. And so the actual test itself may not give any additional information to them, but give a lot of additional information to you. Additionally, when it comes to employer disability insurance, oftentimes group disability insurance looks less into your medical background than if you were just purchasing an individual disability insurance plan. And so it may be easier to get disability insurance through an employer, although they still may be able to take some pre-existing conditions into account. So it can be difficult, and it is an area for consideration. Oftentimes, what some people will do is try to get the disability insurance prior to testing, and see, you know, try to secure the disability insurance, and then they can decide whether to keep it or not after they get the test results back. If you do apply for disability insurance and are denied because of genetic information, as I said, definitely appeal. You can contact our organization, and we have information about how to appeal those cases. The final thing I would say in terms of disability insurance is there are federal disability insurance programs through the Social Security Administration, and these will not take genetic information or medical history into account because they're federal programs. And there are 5 states that have short-term disability insurance programs that also will not take genetic information into account. So even if you are unable to get private insurance, there may still be ways to get disability insurance through state and federal programs.
Thank you. Danielle, is there ever a reason to be retested given these new developments in genetic testing?
I mean, I think the answer to that really is that it depends on your personal and family history.
And so, you know, if somebody was tested, like I said, before these developments became available and tested negative and they still have a strong family history of cancer, that can be frustrating to be left with. So I think that really is kind of a personal decision, but also because these developments are so new, it's something that you might want to ask your genetic counselor. So I would just recommend for people to stay in touch with their genetic counselor, or they are welcome to call me here at Charchart to discuss their personal and family history, and we can kind of talk about which testing might be appropriate, if any. There may not be any testing that I would necessarily recommend. But again, that really just depends on your personal situation.
Okay. Anya, we have a question here that is asking the difference between a state law versus a federal law, and how does that affect coverage?
So both state and federal laws can protect an individual and help them to get access to health insurance or disability insurance. In the arena of health insurance, usually federal law is going to be the most helpful. Somebody might have both a state law and a federal law available to them as a protection, but it's just important to know that you're protected globally, and usually in health insurance arena, the federal laws are going to be the most protective. In the life, long-term care, and disability insurance arenas, there are no federal laws related to genetics in those areas yet. There's some talk about trying to get a federal law, but there's just nothing available right now. So in those cases, you have to look to state law for any protections that somebody may have.
Okay, we seem to have a couple of questions actually about Medicare coverage. So one question is, will Medicare cover tests for adult nieces and nephews? And how do you find that information? And the second part to that question is there a way to appeal when Medicare is not covering?
So Medicare has very specific coverage rules for BRCA, and it has to do with somebody's specific family history and diagnosis themselves. It's very difficult to get coverage for Medicare for somebody who does not have a cancer diagnosis at all. If somebody has been diagnosed with cancer and there's the family history, then it's generally somebody can get Medicare coverage. This is something that genetic counselors are going to be very familiar with, is what the medical side is that requires that you that Medicare requires for you to get coverage. And so that's one way to speak to, you know, the nieces or nephews genetic counselor, somebody in their area, to see what the Medicare rules are in their area. But unfortunately with Medicare, it can be hard to cover. In some cases, you know, I haven't looked up the rules of other companies that are now starting to cover BRCA. If somebody is uninsured or underinsured, it may be possible to get coverage through Myriad. They have patient support where they will lower the cost. But if you have insurance, sometimes you can't get that. So it could be something to look at those new companies that are starting out as well.
Thank you. Dr. Hurley, a question came in about the burden of responsibility in terms of communicating. This woman, and I would imagine many women or men actually on the call tonight who feel that it is important to share information for the health of their family members, but their family members are in denial and don't want to receive the information. What is the responsibility on that man or woman who wants to communicate the information?
Right. So there's, you know, I can speak to more the emotional responsibility in terms of, you know, to what extent there is a, you know, an ethical responsibility. You know, that would, you need to talk with the genetic counselor or the physician who is helping with the testing, you know, to clarify that. But just on the emotional basis, getting through to people, just thinking about, the fact that, this is information that could help you protect your health, okay, and to connect them with a genetic counselor, so that the burden of communicating, all of the ins and outs of risk management, which can be pretty complex, getting across that basic message, but that there are ways that this can work for you. People are fearful of, the idea of getting surgery, or they're fearful of having to step up their surveillance, or fearful of of incurring that guilt that they might have passed on a mutation to their children. So emphasizing that this is something that serves. And then at a certain point, you have to, you can put it in front of them, but then they have to, they do have to take it. And sometimes it's very painful, to have, again, that helpless feeling that, you've done everything you can. It's almost like, think about throwing, if somebody's out in the ocean, you throw them a lifesaver, and your job is to aim well, their job is to grab it. So if you think about what in the message will aim well, and then at a certain point, their free will takes over. So all you can do is sort of be with them and love them even in this state of denial.
Thank you. That's actually very helpful. Danielle, we received a question about using genes to identify targeted treatments. How does that fit into tonight's discussion?
So that's actually, you bring up a great point, which is that there is a difference between tumor testing and germline genetic testing. So I think that that's a question that a lot of people are getting confused about as the technology is advancing so rapidly and as genetics becomes such a big part of medicine and how cancers are being treated. So, some of you, for example, may have heard of Oncotype DX. So that's just one example of where oncologists and surgeons are ordering genetic testing of a tumor to classify the tumor and to figure out how that tumor is best going to respond to certain treatments. That type of genetic testing is very different than the type of genetic testing that we are talking about, which is hereditary cancer genetic testing. So when I say genetic testing, what I'm really talking about is the type of genetic testing that we're trying to identify if there's something going on in the family causing, hereditary cancer to be running through the family. So most genetic counselors that are working in cancer settings are really kind of dealing with that piece of things, whereas if there are specific questions about, treatment or Oncotype DX or tumor testing, that's really what's more being done, in the process of treating breast cancer and kind of how it will best respond to certain treatments.
And I'm sorry, pardon the interruption, ladies and gentlemen. We are still live. Everyone is connected.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Okay, I'm sorry. We seem to have lost connection again. The final question for the evening is, does Sharsheret have resources for patients that cannot afford genetic testing? And also, are there any resources for men in the family who have tested BRCA positive? So the answer to that is yes, yes, yes. Absolutely call Sharsheret for resources, and we can get resources out to you, and we can steer you to particular organizations that will address your particular needs. So, yes, give us a call, and we'd be more than happy to get those resources out to you. I would like to thank all of our speakers and to all of you for joining us for this very productive discussion. Sharsheret Survivorship Program, Thriving Again, was made possible with grants from the federal government Center for Disease Control and Prevention. I would also like to thank Sharon Stahl, Sharsheret's Thriving Again program coordinator, for all her time and hard work in making this evening's program such a success. Please remember to reach out to Sharsheret's genetic counselor, Danielle Singer, who can answer your questions and offer you a peer supporter who had to perhaps consider the difficult decisions that you are facing. Again, if you have not yet received your personalized Thriving Again survivorship kit, send us an email to info@sharsheret.org with your name and contact number, and we'll be in touch with you tomorrow. Sharsheret also offers a financial toolkit to learn how to successfully navigate these often complicated issues of health insurance that was discussed this evening, in addition to disability rights and financial planning. Please visit us online at www.sharsheret.org or call us in the office at 866-474-2774. We are here as you need us, when you need us. Have a great evening.